That's Jimmy Smith, the undisputed master of the Hammond B3 electric organ, opening up with The Sermon, the title track from his 1958 album. At 20 minutes and 12 seconds, this tune took about half of the 40-minute three-track album. Here, he is backed by five extraordinary sidemen: Lee Morgan on trumpet, Lou Donaldson on alto sax, Harold Tina Brooks on tenor, Kenny Burrell on guitar, and Art Blakey on drums. Jimmy Smith, equally adept at hard bop, jazz, funk, and fusion, was born in Norristown, Pennsylvania. He died in his sleep of natural causes on February the 8th, 2005, in Scottsdale, Arizona, at age 79, and he was preparing to go on tour. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, September the 3rd, and it's time to catch up on some international issues. On his eighth trip to Europe as head of state, President Obama arrives in Estonia today to assure Baltic region leaders of U.S. military fidelity, especially against Russian aggression. And then he heads to Wales tomorrow for this year's NATO summit. But even as Obama affirms center stage rights for the United States on the world stage, it's becoming increasingly clear, both at home and abroad, that many question his and his administration's prowess at foreign policy leadership. Lead Stories today updates its July the 30th discussion on Obama's foreign policies, especially in areas of the world beset by war and conflict, and by U.S. involvement. Our guest once again is scholar and prolific author Dr. Gerald Horn, who teaches graduate courses in diplomatic history and is the John Jay and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. A prolific author, he has written more than 30 books and more than 100 scholarly papers and reviews on struggles against imperialism, colonialism, fascism, and racism. His latest book is Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. And Gerald, it's great to have you with us once again.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, the last time we talked about that downward spiral that the president's foreign policy profile seemed to be taking. In the month, how do you rate his profile now?
Well, first of all, just a point of clarification. I think it's very important to speak of President Obama as the chairman of the executive committee of the U.S. ruling elite, and to speak in terms of his foreign policy in collective terms, except when there is a split in this elite, and then he has to weigh in on one side or another, and then you can blame him specifically. For example, with regard to the Libyan intervention of 2011, which has turned into a disaster, wherein then Pentagon Chief Robert Gates was opposed to that intervention, and then the hawks, Hillary Clinton, Susan Rice, and Samantha Power, all weighed in favor, and they drug Mr. Obama along with them. He can be blamed for that. Likewise, with regard to the current crisis in the Ukraine, it's apparent that there is a split in the U.S. ruling elite on Ukraine, and understandably so, because when you have all this loose talk about war involving a nuclear power like Russia, it brings us back to the most dangerous stage that this small planet has faced, perhaps since the so-called October crisis, the so-called Cuban Missile Crisis of October 1962. And with his remarks in Estonia today, Mr. Obama has weighed in on behalf of the hawks. And it's quite reprehensible. It's quite dangerous. And it's also, I should add very quickly, a decision that is bolstered by the fact that the most liberal, left-leaning sector of the body politic, speaking of the Congressional Black Caucus, is asleep on the switch generally with regard to foreign policy. They were asleep on Gaza. They have hid under their desk with regard to the Ukraine.
This they may hid have under the desk, do- Gerald?
Well, you know, maybe under a table. This, of course, we know that if you speak out against the Israeli lobby, you're punished and pulverized, as former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney of Georgia, among others. And we also know that the U.S. ruling elite takes Russia policy very seriously. And I should also say the U.S. left is to blame, because there is a persistent strain of anti-Moscow thinking in the U.S. left that stretches back to the Cold War, a strain that has not been analyzed since the fall of the Soviet Union and is still present. And so to expect President Obama to be a magician, to somehow take positions that even the U.S. left won't take, that the Congressional Black Caucus won't take, they don't have as many responsibilities as he does. So it's really quite a mess and quite an unfortunate state of affairs.
Well, he's headed to the NATO summit tomorrow. And, of course, Ukraine will dominate that discussion. His symbolic stopping off at Estonia today to assure Estonia and Latvia and Lithuania that they can depend on U.S. defense should they suffer any incursions by Russia. I think you're right about this notion going in. In fact, CNN was gloating all day yesterday that he's going to this meeting and he's going to Europe and carrying a message against Russia. So, you know, we do have the revitalization of this East-West Cold War jingoism going on. But at the same time, doesn't Putin display certain disturbing signs as well in terms of encroachment, in terms of expansion of empire? Do you not see that?
I don't take the same position. I wonder what would happen if Russia was involved in Mexico or Canada to the same degree the United States is involved in the Ukraine. More than that, Putin, like any leader, has a historical memory. He recognizes what happened in 1941-42, June 22, 1941 to be specific, when the German military rolled across the border to invade Russia. And of course, we all know that during World War II, approximately 20 million Soviet nationals died. And then before that, in the early part of the 19th century, there was Napoleon Bonaparte seeking to do the same thing. And you have to wonder about the motivations of the United States of America. And to put it in a larger global context, consider that when Mr. Obama was coming into office, he was talking about a reset in relations mm-hmm. with Russia. And that was because of his so-called pivot towards China, recognizing that, as the Financial Times of London reported on April 30th, 2014, by the end of the year, by certain measures, China will have a larger economy than that of the United States. The first time since 1872, the United States has not been the top dog on this small planet, and that was helping to drive Mr. Obama's reorientation towards Asia and towards China specifically. But now the United States finds itself in a very difficult position where it has bad relations with China and Russia simultaneously, something that Henry Kissinger warned the U.S. ruling elite decades ago about. You may have noticed that just in the last few days, you have had U.S. planes buzzing the coast of China, coming within 30 feet of Chinese planes. That could have been a disaster. You may recall what happened in April 2001 when a Chinese when a U.S. plane came down over China, and then the Chinese kept the plane, apparently did some reverse engineering so they could design a similar kind of plane. It led to a very tense standoff, and that is what's happening today. And once again, the Chinese media said what I've just suggested with regard to Russia. What would happen if Chinese planes were buzzing the coast of Florida or the coast of California, for example? Somebody really needs to tell these people in Washington that the days of big stick U.S. imperialism are rapidly drawing to a close, and they need to focus in the United States on their health care system, their education system, their domestic crises like Ferguson, Missouri, which, by the way, the Russian and Chinese press have been covering voraciously, and try to stay out of the internal affairs of sovereign states.
Well, that to just cap this discussion on NATO, the president, therefore, is indicating heavy revitalized militarization of NATO and revitalizing the power of NATO in the region. So what do you expect from his meeting tomorrow with the 28 NATO members? What do you expect the realignment might be, if any, coming out of that summit tomorrow?
It'll be a joke. I mean, they're talking about some 4,000-person rapid response squad that's going to be deposited somewhere along Russia's borders. I mean, it's a joke when you're talking about a country of 150 million people with a nuclear force. But just like U.S. pressure on Ukraine has basically led to a weakening of that state, it's facing an energy crisis since it gets most of its heating and natural gas from Russia. It's facing a financial crisis, a fiscal crisis, a monetary crisis. The state might be splitting in two sooner rather than later because of this U.S. pressure by U.S. hawks, which, by the way, history and memoirs might conclude that Mr. Obama does not have necessary control over all of the organs and personnel of his foreign policy. But putting all this pressure on Western Europe to toe the line is going to lead to a split internally. Scotland is going to be voting to secede from the UK within days. And you may recall that Scotland has been impelled to take that decision, not least because it doesn't like the rightward turn that London has taken with regard to national policies. Francois Hollande of France has been forced not only to purge his left wing from his cabinet, his Socialist Party cabinet, but now we're hearing that a ship that he was going to be sending to Russia, that contract is going to be canceled, which is going to have shipyard workers up in arms. In any case, you may have recalled that in the May 2014 elections in France, the ultra-right, the neo-fascists, did quite well. This whole policy of militarizing Europe and pushing Europe towards confrontation with Russia, it may have the short-sighted consequence of helping to weaken a potential antagonist of the United States and a competitor, I'm speaking of the European Union, whose population of 500 million dwarfs the U.S. population of 330 million. But it'll have the downside impact of possibly leading to internal splits in key European countries like Britain. Note that waiting in the wings after Scotland secedes will be Wales. This policy, as I said, part of the problem is that the left is so weak in the United States that it gives the right wing undue influence. And the right wing in the United States, it's like raising a child who might eat candy for breakfast, lunch, and dinner unless you stop them. Unless you stop the U.S. right wing, they'll militarize everything and drive the whole planet to the point of extinction.
Well, speaking of extinction, there are some, in fact, I talked with some folks who have been observing the rise of the Islamic State, and they're conjecturing that is exactly where things are headed, to some kind of an apocalypse if things keep going on the tracks that they are. The beheadings of James Foley and Stephen Soltoff, connected with the NATO summit, the push for the United States to become far more militarized and militarily involved than it intended to, or at least the president says that he wanted to. What do you make of this? What do you make of the Islamic State and where things are happening in the Middle East?
Well, it's apparent that there's a central contradiction in the execution of the so-called U.S. war on terror, which is that two key U.S. allies, Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, are two of the main sponsors of what has been described as terror. It's well known that the Islamic State got traction because of its seeking to wage war against the Damascus-based regime of President al-Assad, something that the U.S. administration has been winking at. Recall that it was not so long ago that President Obama himself referred to the so-called Islamic State as the junior varsity. Jonathan Landay, the reporter from McClatchy Newspapers, reported in late July 2014 that in late 2013, speaking before Congress, U.S. administration officials downplayed the so-called threat from the Islamic State, so-called. And now,
including Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton said that she was kind of blindsided by ISIS.
Well, it's obvious because they were on the same side with regard to fighting the war against President al-Assad. And as often happens, a Frankenstein monster has been created that has spun out of control. And now the United States is reduced to this rather contradictory, if not chaotic, policy of seeking to bomb the so-called Islamic State on one side of the border in Iraq, while undecided as to what to do about it as it continues to gain strength in Syria. I mean, this is incoherent, but once again, it's not necessarily because the leaders are stupid. I'll leave it to psychologists to come to that conclusion, if they may. But it's because they're conflicting interests at the heart of U.S. foreign policy. That is to say, not only in the U.S. ruling elite itself, but also with regard to its relations with its so-called allies, like Saudi Arabia, which, by the way, buys billions of dollars in weapons from U.S. arms manufacturers, which gives them leverage here in the United States. It buys U.S. Treasury bills to keep the U.S. government afloat, which gives it leverage. Private Saudi investors invest in everything from Fox News to Apple, which gives them gives them leverage in the United States of America. And so it becomes very difficult to resist their blandishments when they come forward with these cockeyed ideas of supporting these religious zealots, which, by the way, is part of a longstanding Saudi policy of seeking to export religious extremism so it somehow does not materialize on its door. But that policy is now coming to an unfortunate close. The problem is that we in North America might become a victim as a result.
The Israeli government, Benjamin Netanyahu, announced just earlier this week that they will be confiscating nearly 1,000 acres of Palestinian land. Presumably that will be used to extend its illegal settlements. And yet the United States, although it issued a strong statement of rebuke and disagreement with that policy, nonetheless, there's nothing beyond it. What should there be? What mechanism should there be to compel the Israeli government to at least adhere to some modicum of international standards and international law?
Well, once again, if you look at the current issue of the New Yorker, there's a very striking article by Connie Bruck on the Israeli lobby, which suggests its influence, particularly, I might add, over some members of the Congressional Black Caucus who have to bend the knee to the Israeli lobby. It's also striking to note that despite the devastation of Gaza in the recent weeks, which led to thousands of Palestinians being killed, it weakened Prime Minister Netanyahu, not least because his forces on the right thought he should have been more aggressive and more bloodthirsty in bombing Gaza. And as a result, his popularity has plummeted, and it's unclear if a snap election were called, which of course he won't call, whether or not he could prevail. Once again, I should reiterate that this has far-reaching consequences for we here in North America, not least because of the United States subsidizing Israeli military aggression. Those bombs should be seen as dollars not going to schools and health care and education and all the rest. But as the New Yorker article points out, and what some of us already knew, the Israeli lobby has basically blocked any sort of agreement with Iran with regard to these nuclear negotiations. And Iran is not a state to play with. It has about 80 million people. It's a strong country, strong militarily, and it's unclear where all of this is leading.
Is it really unclear?
Well, it's unclear to the extent that the worst-case scenario could be a military conflict between Iran and the United States. I don't think that it's preordained that that will happen. That's what makes it unclear. What is clear, of course, is ratcheting up of tensions between Iran and the United States of America. And once again, we have to get to root causes. Part of the problem is the weakness of opposition and left-wing forces, and part of that problem has to do with an unrealistic assessment of these United States of America, beginning with the history. This is, of course, an allusion to my book on 1776, which, as I try to suggest, was a revolt against the abolition of slavery, but which even people in the U.S. left see as some sort of step forward for humanity. So if you can't get that right, if you see the construction of a slaveholding republic as a step forward for humanity, which is a direct slap in the face of people of African descent, not least, well, then how can you get things right in 2014?
The president personally seems to have been on the receiving end of a great deal of open contempt by Netanyahu. Is that likely to change?
I doubt it. As a matter of fact, I think that if we survive climate change and world war, your grandchildren who are historians will be struck by the lack of respect shown to this U.S. president, not only by Prime Minister Netanyahu, but I would say by all other members of the U.S. ruling elite. I think that the Israelis in particular recognize that when you have a black president, that black president carries certain baggage, negative baggage, in a country grounded in white supremacy. The U.S. left, which always talks about racism and white supremacy, they don't seem to get it. And that is nothing new. I think that a historian today who looks at the formation of the State of Israel and look in particular at the role of Ralph Bunche, the black American Nobel laureate who graduated from UCLA and Harvard, you may recall that he was catapulted into that high-level position as the chief UN delegate negotiating with Israel, leading to the formation of the State of Israel, after the Israelis assassinated his predecessor, the Swedish diplomat Count Folke Bernadotte. And I think if you go into the archives, you'll probably find that the Israelis sense that if you got rid of Bernadotte and put a black American in his position who carries less leverage because of white supremacy, then you can run all over him, just like Netanyahu has been running all over Obama. But I'm afraid that despite the fact that some of us are been led to believe that, quote, race matters, unquote, somehow that doesn't ascend to the White House.
The president recently hosted the African U.S.-Africa summit on August the 4th to the 6th to encourage trade. He's clearly late to the party, outpaced by China and Brazil and other major countries in that regard. But is this real trade or, as some contend, a recolonization of the continent by Western and now Eastern powers, referring to China here, looking to basically deplete the continent of its raw resources, the resources of the land?
Well, first of all, those who natter on about China investment in Africa, I wish they would say something about Chinese investment in the United States. China being major players in the buoyancy of the Manhattan real estate market, China being major players in the buoyancy of the Southern California real estate market. The recent Hollywood movie Transformers was a Hollywood-China co-production with all these product placements for Chinese products. I mean, even if you look at the sanctions against Russia, You may have noted that the pork that Russia used to get from Western Europe is now coming from China. China, of course, just bought Smithfields. At least Chinese interests just bought Smithfields, the North Carolina pork producers, which means indirectly you have North Carolina pork going via China to Russia. I can't understand why. Is it because people think Africans are naive, or they don't want to look at Chinese investment in the United States? People, I mean, China's investing all over the world. So I guess people are saying they should invest everywhere except Africa. You know, let the poor Africans fend for themselves. But the United States, I guess, it can stand up for itself, so they can deal mano a mano with China. First of all, with regard to this U.S.-Africa summit, to a certain extent, there was no there. The centerpiece was the so-called Power Plant Initiative, which in many ways will be a giveaway to GE, whose chairman, Jeffrey Immelt, is a close colleague of the Obama White House, not to mention Exelon, which is an Illinois-based corporation that you rarely hear about, even on the left, even though it's been a major supporter of Mr. Obama since he was in the state senate in the state of Illinois. But with the Republican barbarians in Washington having the Export-Import Bank, a government entity on the chopping block, which was slated to finance these power plants in Africa, it's unclear if that power plant initiative is going to take flight. In any case, with regard to the USA-Africa summit, which, as you noted correctly, was a pale imitation of the Chinese summits with Africa over the past decade, the fact of the matter is that the U.S.-Africa summit, in some ways, it was like a one-off. I mean, I'm not sure if there's going to be another one, whereas the China-Africa summits, they're structured. They're liaisons between the ministries of various of the government in Beijing and various countries in the African continent. And in any case, it gives Africans more leverage if they have more than one door to knock on. And I think that Washington and Wall Street recognize that. Why people not in Washington, not on Wall Street, don't recognize that is a mystery to me. That is to say, if the United States, if the African nations only have to go to the North Atlantic countries for trade and investment and all the rest, well, obviously the North Atlantic countries are going to have leverage over the African nations. If they have alternatives, be it in Beijing or Moscow or Brasilia, well, then they have more options. Why that is not painfully and crystal clear is a mystery to me.
What was painfully and crystal clear was that completely absent, it seemed, from those talks on August 4th to 6th during the U.S.-Africa summit, we didn't hear about the U.S. commitment to doing anything about the roiling conflicts that have gripped the nation, civil war in Somalia, the insurgency, the Islamist insurgency in Nigeria and Ghana and neighboring states by Boko Haram. You have in the Central African Republic, you have all kinds of turmoil occurring in Africa, but the United States does not seem to have an articulated policy there.
Well, if you look at yesterday's Washington Post, they talked about the spread of drone warfare bases throughout Africa, in Niger and in Chad in particular, which is a partial product of that misadventure in Libya already alluded to. That is to say, by destabilizing the Gaddafi regime, you basically turned over that country, which borders so many important countries, and that Egypt and Tunisia not least. You basically turned over that country to religious zealots, and therefore that kind of zealotry is now spreading throughout the African continent like an oil splotch, leading then to this drone warfare. I mean, if you look at U.S. policy towards Africa, you may recall that it was over two decades that the first President Bush talked about the United States having more will than wallet. Well, the situation hasn't gotten better since 1990, for example, when the first President Bush was in office. So therefore, with the Export-Import Bank on the chopping block, with drone warfare escalating, well, then it's obvious that the United States doesn't have that much really to offer African nations. And then with regard to the U.S.-Africa summit, you had the barring of attendance by Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe, presumably on human rights grounds. But then that just exposes hypocrisy, because why did they let such bloodthirsty tyrants like the leaders of Cameroon and Equatorial Guinea, just to name a few, into the summit. Obviously, the boycotting of the Zimbabweans has everything to do with the fact that the Zimbabweans had the temerity and the nerve to expropriate the land of a European minority, some of whose roots only stretch back to 1945. That is to say, their roots are very shallow in the country, and that being a message with regard to others who want to oppose settler colonialism, including the settler colonialism that led to the formation of the United States of America in the first place.
But we have an entirely different articulation, a very conscious one and a deliberate one, with regard to North African countries. How do you explain the dichotomy in the Obama administration and the way it responds to North Africa and the way it responds to sub-Saharan Africa?
Well, first of all, North Africa is part of the alleged remit of the Israeli lobby, and as already knows, as anybody who studies U.S. policy recognizes, the Israeli lobby wields maximum power in Washington, D.C. Second of all, the key country in North Africa is Egypt, which is a heavyweight of the continent, which controls the Suez Canal, which, by the way, the current leadership tells us is about to be expanded, which will only increase the strategic value of Egypt if that takes place, and even if it doesn't take place. The Suez Canal is one of the key waterways on this small planet. And so I think that that, in part, helps to account for this differing strategy towards North Africa and what is referred to as sub-Saharan Africa. But if the implication of your question is that there is discrimination against sub-Saharan Africa stretching back to the bad old days of the African slave trade, and that that stigma and malignancy has yet to dissolve, well, I would not disagree with you.
Very diplomatically put, Gerald. Let's talk a bit about Asia and the great pivot by the Obama administration. How do you assess it?
Well, it's very difficult because it was supposed to be accompanied by the reset with Russia, and that's obviously gone down the drain, gone down the tubes. And it's very interesting that this current regime of Xi Jinping is taking a hard line on many different issues. Yeah, I mean, you may have noticed what happened with regard to Hong Kong and the so-called Occupy Central movement, Hong Kong being the former British colony that reverted to China in 1997 under the one country, two systems slogan and reality. There are those in Hong Kong who want to see direct elections of their political leaders. The leadership in Beijing has basically said no. And as a person who used to live in Hong Kong and still follows events there and still listens to the media there, I'm struck by the fact that China may take a very hard line against these Hong Kongers, and I choose my words carefully, up to and including what we saw in Tiananmen Square in June 1989. Well, let us hope not. But in any case, I don't think the reset is going very well, in part because of the Chinese economy. I mean, there are those who suggest that within decades, there is a possibility that the Chinese economy may be larger than the United States economy by several orders of magnitude. I mean, this is an extraordinary event in terms of world history. I don't expect it, but I would hope that those who think that they specialize in studying white supremacy might take a look at that for at least a few seconds, although I wouldn't bet on it. And so as a result, this pivot towards Asia is not going very well. And just like I suggested that this hard line against Russia is having numerous negative consequences for Britain and France, among others, I think that the pivot toward Asia is really going to have negative consequences for Australia, which on the one hand has China as its chief trading partner, whose economy has been buoyant, not least because of trade with China, but relies on the United States for, quote, security, unquote. Recall that Mr. Obama visited Northern Australia some years ago, where he then dispatched thousands of U.S. forces to Darwin, Australia, to be sort of a U.S. military base on that continent, which many in the Australian left objected to, as well they should have. So, once again, I don't see that pivot going very well.
And the long-standing issues with North Korea continue to flare up. How do you read the Obama administration's foreign policy there?
Well, it's just a continuation of the past. I should say that in about 10 days, I'm going to Honolulu. You know, I've done a couple books on with Honolulu, with Hawaii as a focus. And one of the points that I'm going to make when I'm speaking there is that Hawaii, which styles itself as this sort of midway point between East and West, is closer to Tokyo than it is to New York, even though it's part of the United States of America. It was the site of the bombing of Pearl Harbor, which marked a turning point in U.S. history, Hawaiian history, and Asian and world history, that the Hawaiians should call an international conference of labor, inviting unions from China and Japan. China and Japan have very bad relations right now. It's one of the most dangerous relationships right now that the world faces, that in some way dwarfing the tensions between Moscow and Washington right now. They should invite the trade unions from North Korea and South Korea. The relations there are not very good. They should invite trade unionists from Australia for reasons already noted. Because obviously this, depending upon this U.S. administration, whatever its intentions may be, and its numerous supporters on the North American mainland, is leading us to the precipice of a possible catastrophe. And so, therefore, we need some sort of bottom-up approach to drag us away from the precipice.
Which countries would you say in Asia are leading the way to a new kind of regional leadership, if you will, that is different from what even they had experienced before, but specifically different from the relationship between Asian countries, the historic relationship between Asian countries and the United States?
That's a very difficult question. I can only speak about gradualism, which I'm sure many of your listeners don't want to hear. That is to say that the present Indonesian regime, the recent elections that took place there weeks ago, led to the installation of an administration that's going to be significantly better than the previous administration and significantly better than the Suharto regime, the military dictatorship that ruled from the bloodbath of October 1965 up until about a decade ago. With regard to South Korea, I'm heartened by the positive relations between South Korea and China, although that too has a downside because both of those regimes have a bone to pick with Tokyo, and in many ways they're sort of uniting on the altar of anti-Tokyo relations, which is leading to another possible positive aspect, which is that in response, North Korea has been warming up relations with Japan, given the fact that North Korea has been accused repeatedly of trying to develop a nuclear regime so as to threaten Japan. Whatever reason leads to a positive relation between Tokyo and Pyongyang is probably a positive development. I can't say that I'm heartened by recent developments in India, not least because of Prime Minister Modi's right-wing Hindu chauvinism, which is, I'm afraid, really rather frightening. On the other hand, it's both positive and negative with regard to China. I mean, it's obvious that both China and Japan and India are uniting. Their relations are becoming better, but once again, like South Korea and China, it's on the basis of a sort of anti-China platform, which is dangerous. But at the same time, I think it has the potential of dragging more Indians out of poverty, and given the fact that there are more Indians in poverty than there are Africans in poverty, that's probably a great thing.
To the hemisphere and talk about Central and South America. There has been, because of this immigration issue and the refugee issue, a great concentration on what the region is doing as a region, separate and apart from U.S. interference. Could you talk about any inroads that you see that have been made in that regard, a consolidation of a regional effort as opposed to this dependency on U.S. Relations?
Well, first of all, you may have noticed that in terms of that recent crisis of children crossing the border, there were hardly any children from Nicaragua crossing the border, which is quite striking to study, and that's probably an outgrowth of the fact that the often reviled Sandinista regime, which is still in power in Managua, has pursued policies that tend to make its citizenry less prone to embark on the perilous path to entering southern Texas. I should also say that the Nicaraguans were in the process of trying to build a canal that would challenge the Panama Canal, and they're doing it with the assistance of Chinese interests, which obviously is raising eyebrows in Washington. As you probably know, the Cubans have been at the forefront of trying to knock together different kind of regional alternatives that include the Central Americans, including the Bolivarian alternative for the Americas. You should also know that Brazil is going to have an election within a month or so, and Brazil has been at the forefront of challenging U.S. policy in the hemisphere, in Central America not least. Recall that when there was a coup in Honduras in the early stages of the Obama administration, it was the Brazilians who sought to challenge U.S. policy that ultimately backed that coup. Well, it's unclear if the current leader, Dilma Rousseff, is going to prevail. She has another female challenger, Silva, who has sort of a vague platform, but because of discontent with Dilma, it may lead to her being dislodged, although, quite frankly, I hope not. With regard to Mexico, the Nieto regime in Mexico, his popularity, it's plummeting. First of all, there was the effort to move away from a state-centered energy industry. You know that Mexico is a major oil producer, and Mexican nationalization of the oil in the 1930s under former President Cárdenas really struck a chord of hope and optimism with Mexicans, and therefore this move away from the state-centered oil industry was not greeted with popularity, to put it mildly. On the other hand, President Nieto has just announced that the airport in Mexico City is going to be expanded, which could have enormous consequence for the North American mainland, that is to say, meaning the United States of America.
Could we talk about the impact of BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, and the likely economic impact it will continue to have, but it already has gained significant ground?
Well, you know, the BRICS has been analogized to Gladys Knight and the Pips, with China being Gladys Knight and the rest of these countries being the Pips, just saying ooh-ah in the background. And that's not necessarily an exaggeration, because certainly China dwarfs Russia, India, South Africa by several orders of magnitude. Of course, the new BRICS Bank, which is going to challenge the World Bank in terms of funding infrastructure, bridges, airports, roads, is a welcome development, because once again, it's very important for developing countries to have more than one door to knock on, and just having the World Bank door to knock on in Washington, D.C., that one door is just not advantageous. Likewise, they're trying to challenge the International Monetary Fund based in Washington, D.C., which is also positive, since, as we well know, there's such a thing called IMF riots. That is to say, the IMF goes to countries and then lends it money to cover budget deficits or other kinds of crises, but then demands in return that subsidies for healthcare and education are slashed, which then leads people to go to the streets and protest. So I think that the BRICS is a very hopeful development. It's once again a reflection of the changing correlation of forces globally, whereby the North Atlantic countries are losing altitude, fortunately enough. But once again, that losing altitude is having negative consequences, because they're trying to compensate by ratcheting up tensions, not least with regard to where we began with this crisis in Ukraine.
Well, many of the old-time Caribbean leaders had, particularly Michael Manley, had been talking about the need for South-South cooperation. Are you seeing any correlation between this effort at coalescing their economic power in Central and South America having a spillover effect in the Caribbean?
Well, absolutely. You may recall that President Xi Jinping, I think it was in the summer, June 2013, met in Trinidad with the CARICOM leaders. And those CARICOM leaders all left with goodies of various sorts. That is to say, various kinds of installation and projects to be sponsored by Beijing. But in any case, that sent a message to Washington to pull up its socks, to get its act together, to not presume that it can bully Caribbean leaders so they have no other door to knock on. I would also say that this effort by the Caribbean leaders to get reparations is a wholesome development, and I particularly compliment Professor Hilary Beckles of Barbados, the University of the West Indies, whose writings in this regard and whose speaking in this regard, not least in Chicago a few months ago, has been very stirring, very uplifting, and has provided something of a role model for we of North America in terms of trying to get our reparations act together. I would also say that the Caribbean nations have been major players with regard to some of the Cuban initiatives, such as the Bolivarian Alternative for the Americas, that the Caribbean nations have benefited from subsidized oil from Venezuela, which is also, you could ascribe to this Cuban initiative. So, sure, there's room for improvement, but quite frankly, I would say that the Caribbean nations could be given a passing grade to a degree.
Oh, well, that's good. That's hopeful.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, let's come back to and do a kind of summary here for the month that we have not talked about foreign policy, and come back to where this places our President Barack Obama.
Well, my position with regard to Mr. Obama is that with regard to domestic policy, where he faces these right-wing barbarians, that he merits support in those struggles against the right wing with regard to slashing food stamps, with regard to slashing health care funds, et cetera, with regard to slashing Medicare, privatizing Medicare and all their other lunatic plans. But with regard to foreign policy, where basically every nation in the world is to the left of the United States of America, I think it would be suicidal to support these foreign policies, not least of all in Central and Eastern Europe. The problem is that those two issues are linked. That is to say, what happens is that much of our leadership takes the opposite point of view. The left-wing leadership tends to oftentimes support Obama's foreign policy, like so many left-wing people, believe it or not, supported the bombing of Libya, which was the looniest ideas as Looney Tunes. But, and then you have our black leadership, who will oftentimes support him on domestic policy and foreign policy. And it seems to me that both of these approaches are leading us over the cliff.
So, when the president returns, what do you expect in terms of what the immediate foreign policy response would be? Would there be a dramatic militarization? Is it going to be the heeding the call for war? We have people like John McCain and others saying it's time to really drag out the old weaponry and let's go bombing. But is the president, he's being seen as being very indecisive, frankly, quite cowardly in some quarters, that he is just unwilling to take on a tough decision and make a tough call. Is it as simple as that?
No, it's not simple as that. I think that the United States got its nose bloodied in Iraq and Afghanistan, but that was not a sufficient lesson for the likes of John McCain. They want their noses bloodied in Syria next. Part of the problem, as many mainstream commentators have pointed out, that if ISIS is such a threat, why are those billions of dollars in Saudi warplanes still sitting on the tarmac? If ISIS is such a threat, why is not Turkey, which borders on Iraq, not being more vigorous in getting into the fray? One of the things we haven't talked about is this crisis in Afghanistan and Pakistan. In Afghanistan, you're going to have the NATO meeting this week in Wales, UK. The centerpiece was supposed to be NATO's main project to this point, which has been the Afghan war theater. And yet, it's unclear if anybody but President Karzai is going to show up, because the two leading contenders to replace him are involved in a death match to see who's going to replace him. And it's unclear where that's going to lead Afghanistan besides perhaps a Taliban takeover within 6 to 12 months, if not sooner. With regard to Pakistan, a major supporter of what's referred to as terrorism, you have demonstrations, thousands of people storming the residence, not to mention the capital of Islamabad, which heretofore has been sort of an oasis of quiet and tranquility compared to the mega cities like Karachi and Lahore. And that's led to a slow motion coup where the military is trying to push out the leader, Nawaz Sharif, and they've already stripped him of power over foreign policy, power over relations with Afghanistan, power over relations with India, and he may be a goner before I hang up the phone. And that's going to lead to an even deeper crisis in a nuclear-armed state on the border of another nuclear-armed state, speaking of India. So what's going to happen when President Obama returns to Washington? I think his inbox is going to be filled with even more problems.
Let me ask you frankly, do you agree with the assessment that the president in this particular realm, the realm of foreign policy, is pretty much in over his head?
No. As I see it, they're just conflicting interests. That is to say, I mean, take the issue of China. The United States ruling elite is not united about China. In any class, for example, the U.S. working class, that tries to accomplish a goal while being disunited, it's going to stumble and fumble because they're not united. And that even holds true for the U.S. ruling class. So, as noted, they're not united on policy towards Russia. They're not united on policy towards China. There's even splits on policy toward Cuba of late, which I had thought would never happen. So Mr. Obama, only being the chairperson of the ruling elite, is trying to conciliate these various tendencies, these various factions. And it's like rowing a boat. Sometimes he has to row to the left, and sometimes he has to row to the right. And that leads to charges of incoherence, and that leads to charges of weakness. But basically, it's an organic problem. It's an inherent problem stemming from the factionalism that besets these United States of America.
Well, just to wrap up, I wanted to ask you about one person who is kind of been getting by without much criticism, and that is Hillary Clinton. She factors in very heavily in a lot of the disarray that we are experiencing in terms of foreign policy. How has she managed that?
Well, it's very interesting. The New York Times had an article the other day about how the Congressional Black Caucus is telling all the black people to go out and vote, otherwise we'll suffer another Ferguson, Missouri. Yet just before then, they reported that all of the national leaders of the Democratic Party, Hillary Clinton not least, had been silent on Ferguson, Missouri. So if you can't get the party that we vote for at a rate of 9-1 to speak out when we're being slaughtered like pigs in the streets, well, then obviously we're in trouble. Now, finally, former Secretary of State Clinton gave a speech a few days ago where she made some lip service towards the victim, Michael Brown and Ferguson, blah, blah, blah. But she's going to be pilloried when she runs for office in 2016 because of Benghazi. Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, who has been taking this anti-intervention stance and takes other positions, which I vehemently disagree with, not least his attack on the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which he tried to walk back, has pointed out correctly that Hillary's counseling of war in Libya led directly to the catastrophe of Ambassador Chris Stevens being killed in September 2012 in Benghazi, irrespective of what her direct role was in terms of helping send troops to come to Ambassador Stevens' defense. How she has been able to escape criticism thus far, I think it's easy to answer. She does not hold office. As of now, she has not declared for an office. But as is well known, by this time next year, she probably will have declared for an office. And that's when the attacks will begin.
Well, Gerald, I want to thank you so much. This was a truly a whirlwind tour of foreign policy today. And anybody listening, I'm sure it's like a college course crammed into 1 hour. So I want to thank you so very much for doing what you usually do, which is to bring light to a lot of darkness. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. Stay tuned. Keep it right here. Alternative Visions with Jack Rasmus is up next. Reach me at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Let me know how these programs are resonating with you. And again, as usual, I want to tell you how pleased I am that I consistently find that people are making the very best effort to engage with each other on this program. It is a great, great compliment, not just to me, but to each other, because this is how we learn. We trade our information. So I want to thank you for consistently delivering your very, very best. And with those remarks, I want to thank you for listening to me today and to listening to this program. I certainly learned a lot. I hope you did. And it is a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.